Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. You are only going to listen to me at the very beginning and at the very end, because for the rest of the time, we have Patrick Bufuma and Lauren Westifer on to do our first ever Emergency Medicine Infectious Disease Podcast, or EMID. And this is the brainchild of Patrick. A few months ago, if you recall, I was asking people that if you were interested in doing something, go ahead and contact me so we can start doing podcasts together. And I had a couple of people reach out. One of them was Patrick, and Patrick was on the spot, ready to go. He has some podcasting experience. We actually first met at the podcasting course in person, and he has been doing a lot of other types of things as well. But I'm going to include a lot of that in the show notes, such as his work with EMS and Focus. And then I also have Lauren Westifer, and Lauren Westifer is awesome. She is in Feminine. She does the Foamcast podcast. She does all sorts of great things. And the reason why Lauren Westifer was specifically asked to do this is because of her experience with spinal epidural abscess type diagnosis. With spinal epidural abscess, you really want someone who has seen quite a few of these. And Lauren works at a shop where they do a lot of research on this, and they're kind of at the forefront of this. So I want to make sure to include her opinions and her information about this. So Patrick reached out, interviewed her, and it is phenomenal. So let's get right into it.
So Dr. Westifer, I'm looking at the literature, and is Bay State the epicenter of epidural abscesses, or are we just missing a whole lot of them? What's going on out there?
Yeah, I'm guessing that you've probably read the studies from our group at Bay State that has published a couple on spinal epidural abscess. But yeah, no, I think that, I don't know about like in your neck of the woods, but these are really increasingly common. I work in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is a urban center with lots of IV drug use and lots of sick patients. And so we've seen that we've had an increasing number of these. In 2005, we had 2.5 per 10,000, so not a ton. But up in 2018, this went up to 8 per 10,000. So it seems like small numbers, but that's three times as many spinal epidural abscesses we found in a span of 10 years. And during this time, it's also just kind of just keep in mind that the time MRI became increasingly accessible was also during that time. But, you know, it's still not like quick or easy to get an MRI. But I don't know whether it's just we're seeing more spinal epidural abscesses or we're detecting ones that we missed before because we didn't use MRI as frequently.
So I'm getting the impression that you're essentially just MRIing everyone since you have the capability to do so. Is that what's going on at Bay State?
Yeah, that would explain our waiting room waits of 8 hours. No, we don't MRI everyone. But we do have a protocol that sort of is kind of liberal towards MRIing a bunch of people. And it was developed, I think, based on a similar protocol that has been at other institutions. In 2011, there was a publication by Davis et al. That sort of laid out a protocol, and ours is similar to that. And it essentially starts with the question, does this patient have new back or neck pain or acute and new worsening of chronic pain in the absence of other etiologies for that pain?
All right. And when we say other etiologies, what do you mean by that?
I mean, it seems intuitive. A patient has mechanical back pain, they have sciatica. But the problem is that when you have a protocol, sometimes it gets over-applied indication creep. So residents may sometimes, occasionally, or often go down this pathway and towards spinal epidural abscess, and you're like, this is clearly mechanical back pain, or they have phylo or zoster or something like that. So there are often other etiologies that we can sort of identify, strain, sprain, or infectious causes that are unrelated or less likely to be. So if a patient has new or worsening back pain, and then they've also had bacteremia recently, or a recent history of spinal infection, like discitis, osteomyelitis, or something, then that patient gets a stat MRI.
All right. So you have this patient with new back pain without another explanation, and they don't meet these criteria. So they haven't had recent bacteremia. They haven't had a recent spinal infection. So then what are you doing?
So if they have that new back pain, no other explanation, and they don't meet one of those criteria, the question is, do they have risk factors for spinal epidural abscess? And if they do, then they get that stat MRI. And the risk factors that are specifically included in our protocol are things like intravenous drug use, which seems pretty clear, spinal procedure or injection in the past 6 months. Again, that's pretty, you know, intuitive. Indwelling vascular catheter or foreign body, an ED visit or antibiotics within the past 30 days or known infectious foci elsewhere.
All right, so they've got new back pain and they have a risk factor, then they are getting an MRI?
Yep, exactly. And then they can also get an MRI if, say, they don't have a risk factor, but they do have a fever, like temperature greater than 100.4 Fahrenheit, and an elevated ESR or CRP. In those cases, even without a risk factor, they have that new or worsening back pain and fever and elevated SED rate or CRP inflammatory marker, then they get the MRI too.
All right, so you'll get a lot of patients who will come in and they say, yeah, I had a fever 3 days ago, or yeah, it was febrile at home. And, you know, in triage, it's like 98.6. And then you repeat it 3 hours later and it's, you know, 98.4. Are you taking the home fever with a grain of salt? Or if they report a fever at home, does that count?
Yeah, that's a really, I think, important question that we don't have a good answer to. It's up to interpretation. There are a lot of debates in the literature surrounding reported fever versus documented fever. And I think most of it really encourages us to use reported fever. And maybe a patient took ibuprofen or Tylenol. And maybe they ever never actually had a fever, but we kind of want to be a little more on the conservative side. It does vary provider to provider. The protocol doesn't specifically say you must have a documented temperature greater than 100.4. Because I think, too, it's like, do you take a rectal temp on all these patients? Because we know oral and rectal core temps can differ, you know, kind of differ. So it's not super clear here. But I typically use reported fever.
And I don't know about you, in my facility, a stat x-ray gets done within, you know, 2 or 3 hours. What's a stat MRI then?
So stat currently means anywhere between 2 and 6 hours. We have a 2-hour protocol and a 6-hour protocol, and it depends on whether there are neurodeficits in the patient and theoretically a discussion with neurology to decide, is this a 2-hour protocol study or a 6-hour protocol study? Most end up being in the sort of 6-hour protocol. And they studied it sort of before and after the implementation of this protocol. And we average about 3.5 hours of time to ordering to time the scan is done. It's about 3.5 hours is stat.
And this is this 24 hours a day? Is this like, you know, 2 a.m. they come in, you are mobilizing troops for an MRI in the middle of the night?
MRI is always there. So typically you're not mobilizing, you're shifting. What happens is the inpatient people will be, they'll be doing inpatient MRIs overnight, not like calling in a STEMI team to do this. They're already there. It's just bumping other patients.
That's impressive. All right. So you talked about SED rate. We talked about CRPs. How about the newest kid on the block? What about procalcitonin? Was there any push to use a procal at Bay State?
Not yet. We really don't use it a lot at Bay State, and it's not really part of the protocol yet. So I have zero answer for you on that. And as far as I know, there's not a ton of literature specifically regarding spinal epidural abscess or discitis or ostia or anything like that. Do I get into risk factors some?
Yeah, let's talk about risk factors a little bit. It looks like only 20% of patients had a history of IV drug abuse, which says we are probably missing a lot. And since you're MRIing everybody, why don't you tell me what other risk factors they had out there?
Yeah, so 20% had the IV drug use and another 20% indwelling catheter, 20% history of ETOH abuse or chronic kidney disease. 10% had spinal instrumentation in the past year. I think we all think about it as this huge risk factor, but again, it's probably just a little bit less common. Recent antibiotics were actually 35.2% of people who were diagnosed with an SEA when they look back had recent antibiotics in the past 30 days.
Wow, so that's almost double. So 35% versus 20-ish percent. So what's the experience with that? What are patients typically saying? Were they like recently treated for pneumonia? Were they, erroneously treated for pylo and their back pain was really an abscess? Was it cellulitis? May have hematogenously spread. What trends did you see, if at all?
Patrick, I'm pretty sure there is no typical story in my experience for spinal epidural abscess. I see a lot of the people with IV drug use who come in with pain of some sort. And maybe that's just because of those are the ones I'm more inclined to scan. And often they're like, the pain is variable. Once I saw somebody who came in with a sore throat, but their oropharynx looked totally clear. And I was like, why do you have a sore throat? And it turned out it was more like everything in the neck was tight. When I had the partner leave, the patient was like, oh, I sort of recently relapsed back on IV heroin. And they had their whole C&T spine was just phlegma. Like, I don't even know if there was bone there. But a lot of it is a patient will have actually had true pyelo. Like, you look at the urine and you're like, that was dirty. And they had flank pain that wasn't really true, like midline back pain. And what happens is these infections, especially if you have a little bit of immunosuppression as well, which, you know, the CKD, the indwelling catheter or something like that, it just ends up kind of seeding and then causes that. So I think that it's just infection can cause the hematogenous spread of this. But yeah, I don't know about a typical story.
I'm going to go a little bit off topic here on this one. What is the fail-safe for urinalysis and for urine culture? So I've been a little bit vigilant with people who have grown out Staph aureus to call them back within like the next 3 or 4 weeks to see how they are and if they have any recurrence, because those are people that I sort of have put on a radar. I guess, who does your callbacks, and have you noticed anything in terms of Staph aureus urinemia as being a big red flag on your end?
So our follow-up, we have a dedicated follow-up nurse who does the callbacks, on patients. And that's something that I specifically don't know. I, have a disclosure to make, and it's that I do not personally follow up the urine cultures of all of my patients or call them back. I'm just not that good of a doctor. Especially like, you know, if it's a shift with residents, I mean, we may be seeing 50 patients. And so I don't have the capacity to track all those down. So, but we have a follow-up nurse who tracks those down, and I don't know. I mean, I would be wary of Staph aureus in anybody's urine. That would be concerning to me. But I don't specifically follow those up just because I don't encounter the cultures frequently.
All right. So let's go back to risk factors here. And, not seeing a ton of classically immunosuppressed patients. So not a lot of diabetics. I'm not seeing HIV positive patients, not on biologics. So can we just sort of toss these patients and keep it a little bit simple then?
Yeah, you actually don't have to worry about that at all. Biologics, totally fine. HIV, no, I'm just kidding. I hope that's not taken seriously. No, I think that one of the reasons here is that HIV patients or patients on biologics, they tend to be less common than the other things. Patients who have CKD, for example, or chronic liver disease, or recent antibiotic use or IV drug use, it's just less common. And especially with the biologics, that data is really hard to dredge out for a chart review, which is how these protocols come about and how they're created in the first place. So just as a researcher, just knowing the limitations of how these things are created, you often can't get what meds a patient is on. And so those often don't come into play. Just one thing to note is that the protocol from Davis et al. In 2011, they did have immunocompromised as a general category. So, which is, you know, fairly open, which of course would include IV, you know, HIV patients on biologics or other immunosuppressants and things like that. And then I think, again, this is just a call to kind of use a little bit of clinician gestalt when you have a protocol, because they are often, these guidelines or clinical decision tools are often based on what you can get out and what turns out to be statistically significant from a retrospective chart review, and all the information isn't there. And then the other thing is that some things you may not include because they're so prevalent that it would mean MRIing absolutely everyone, like diabetes and obesity, are, you know, fairly common in this population and have been in some of the protocols, but it also means MRIing essentially everybody where I work, which just wouldn't be feasible and would be way less specific.
All right, so you implement this protocol, and what was your yield before and after? Were you just MRIing a bunch more people only to capture like 2-4% of patients actually having an epidural abscess? So what was it? What was the yield before the protocol? What was it after the protocol?
Fortunately or unfortunately, our yield is not just 5%, but the yield was essentially the same before and after. It was 16.1% in the 7 months before introduction of the protocol, and 17.7% in the 7 months following the introduction of the protocol. And when I give you the stats that way, it really sounds unimpressive, right? Like there's maybe like a 1.6% increase in detection of significant findings. And especially if you note that the MRI use increased by 160% in those 7 months, which is like a lot. But in the 7 months pre-protocol, 57 were scanned, and then 147 in the 7 months after. So it sounds like it's, again, not that impressive, but the absolute number diagnosed in the 7 month period after was three times as many. So there were only 9 in the pre-protocol 7 months and 26 in the post-protocol period, which I can't think of a good explanation as to why in just 14 months, all of a sudden you would see this huge uptick, unless it was, we're just detecting more of them. I don't think that there's a seasonal variation to spinal epidural abscess. So I think really it was the yield did go up. The absolute numbers really went up, and we did scan a lot of extra patients as well.
So how did the mindset change before and after? Did a lot of eyes get opened up? I guess were people's eyes rolling when they said, oh my God, we're going to be MRIing everyone? I mean, epidural abscess sort of seems to be one of these out of sight, out of mind diagnoses.
Yeah, and I think that it definitely was. And there was like this huge sort of interdisciplinary push for this. So it really came from the chair of our department. It came from the quality improvement and performance improvement folks. And it basically was, there was this flow sheet on all the computers. And so it was really pushed, and it was like, now I have to MRI everybody. Their length of stays are going to be incredible. So it brought a lot of attention to the diagnosis. Before, everyone was like, spinal epidural abscess, it would be like rare, almost never on a resident's differential for back pain. But now it's like, back pain, I got to rule out SEA. And we're seeing a ton of transfers to our center for MRI from hospitals that don't have access for spinal epidural abscess. So I don't think it's just at our center. So it's good on that front, because we're, you know, thinking about it more, and especially we have a high risk population where I work. On the other hand, we have a lot of negative MRIs. And so maybe we're over applying the protocol, or it could be sort of refined a little bit better, but it could be a pretty morbid diagnosis. So knowing exactly where that threshold is kind of hard.
Yeah. 17% sort of sounds like a significant yield here, but by the same token, when you look at the paper of what you considered a positive study, they only considered an abscess. So vertebral osteo, discitis, and facet joint infections without an abscess, they actually didn't consider that a positive finding, which, I mean, to me, if I'm a provider in the ED and I find vertebral osteo versus an epidural abscess, I'm equally as excited. You know, they're still going to be admitted, but
yeah, I mean, because then you have a clear dispo for their back.
Especially if you get the MRI in a couple hours. So, I mean, it seems like the yield might even approach 20% or maybe even higher. I think that in our OBS unit, we have sort of taken an approach. We haven't taken as rigorous an approach applying this protocol, but we've been fairly liberal in doing a SED rate, a CRP, and if it comes back high, we just put them in OBS for an MRI. And anecdotally, over, we've probably done this 3 or 4 years, our hit rate is probably 25%. We probably get 6 to 8 a year. But when you keep in mind that we're a shop of 28, 30,000 patients a year, that's a fair amount for a small shop. And that's way more than we were seeing 4 or 5 years ago. So are there any sort of general themes that we're seeing here that are coming out in terms of who sort of pretty little piles that we can put patients in or overarching risk factors here?
Yeah, I mean, you've heard of the Westover triad, right? The immunocompromised, so alcohol abuse, CKD, the elderly, people who put things where they don't belong, IV drug use, indwelling catheters or lines, recent procedures, and then the recurrently ill, you know, recent antibiotic use, recent, you know, infection, bacteremia, et cetera. You're familiar with that, right? It just portends badness in any population and disease process.
If you have an N of one or more, or a one or more of these risk factors, it's an MRI, correct?
Yeah, I mean, entire body MRI. But yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to think about these things. People with suppressed immune systems, and especially like with back pain or fever and infectious focus, and then people who put things where they don't belong or have indwelling lines, like I think oftentimes we forget about those ports or things like that and how much they can actually like seed infections. You know, and I think that really when you have a patient that has a fever and those things, it's easy to be like, well, maybe that urine looks a little bit dirty. Maybe that explains their back pain. But I think really thinking about it in the context of, is the urine really that dirty? Is their back pain really explained by that? I think that putting people in sort of those piles can kind of help.
So you had mentioned this example about the person with a sore throat, and then they had phlegma sort of up and down their C and T spine. So in your shop, are they getting a CT and L spine? Are you only doing sort of a focus of where there's pain? If it's kind of vague, are you doing above and below? How does that work?
I mean, well, usually we're doing an MRI, not a CT.
C-spine, T-spine, L-spine.
Oh, gotcha. I thought you said a CT of those. I was like, we usually, like, we don't do, some places we'll do a CT and then MRI. So it sort of depends. Often we find non-contiguous abscesses, and I think that's fairly well documented. So I'm relatively liberal in that. However, if I find, especially if it's on the cusp, like lower thoracic or upper thoracic or lower cervical or upper lumbar, I mean, I'm pretty good at palpation, but it's hard to know like exactly which, you know, interspace and which spinous process could theoretically the infection be. So if I'm worried about it, I will often order two areas unless it's very clear this is very low lumbar. You know, I'll just order that one, or super high cervical. Often if it's like a thoracic or a lumbar, I end up ordering the other one above or below that. I tend to not order all three at the same time unless there really is a clear indication for that. Because what often happens is I'll find the one. For example, I had a recent IV drug use patient, septic, super sick, and had very clear thoracic pain. And we did a thoracic and lumbar because they had just sort of mid-thoracic, maybe a little bit lower. It caught the thoracic and lumbar epidural abscess. So then we went back and scanned the cervical, but at that point it wasn't going to change management. So often if you find the one, you can go back if you're really curious and get the other ones. You just don't want to miss that zone of where you might find it. So if it's like between sort of the cervical and thoracic, then I would just get both.
All right. So next shift, community shop, they don't have MRI at night, or maybe they don't have MRI over the weekend. Patient has subjective fever at home. They're coming with back pain. Sed rate is sky high. Are you transferring them, or are you admitting them for an MRI the next day, or is the soonest chance that the inpatient team can do it?
I mean, if I really think that this very well could be that, and I make myself try to think about that because transfers are not benign. I really try to think, do I really think that this could be an SEA? I transfer the community place where I moonlight. There really is only MRI a couple of days a week. So there could be a fairly large gap between when I admit them and then when they actually get the MRI. It's not just like I'm working an overnight shift and in 3 hours they're going to get it. At which point, I mean, the transfer process can very well take that long. So I will often transfer that patient because I just don't have access. The community and culture at each place is different. But for me, I tend to move a little bit quickly because of potential neurologic sequelae, and I don't want a patient to wait 3 to 4 days before they make it an MRI.
All right. Well, sounds good. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Any other closing thoughts or any other questions, concerns, comments?
No, I think this is super interesting, and I'm glad that you've sort of brought attention to it because it's something that we're seeing, you know, everyone is focusing so much on, and, you know, I think we were probably missing it for a really long time because we didn't have the access to MRI people, and we just weren't thinking about it. And so I really think it's interesting, and I wonder if part of this is the opioid epidemic sort of pushed people this way, because we're finding in a lot of people that don't have IV drug use as a risk factor. But I think that we've been sort of more liberal about thinking about it, maybe because of that. So I think it's a very interesting disease process to think about how we may have been wrong for a long period of time or missing people. And that's kind of scary.
So actually, probably just under 50% of the people at our shop are these elderly people who are coming back for a repeat visit, their urinary tract infection's back, and you kind of get this borderline UA, or maybe it's not a clean catch, and they were admitted, and they were a little bit kooky before, and then they're back, and they're, my UTI is back, and 6 weeks ago you look, and they were bacteremic, and the family was brought them back, they were being vigilant, but we have caught a fair number of abscesses like that. So I've kind of have always wondered if that's been part of it. And part of it is our OBS unit has been a little bit more aggressive about trying to find them, rather than just this wash, rinse, repeat of coming in, being partially treated with a week of antibiotics, go home, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think that you bring up a good point too, is the return visit is like, you always want to be aware of that, because like it really may not be clear on the first visit, and these things develop with kind of variable rapidity. So I think like whenever you have a patient who is recently here, was treated for like maybe a UTI, even though the patient's like, yeah, I had a urinary tract infection, sometimes like looking back and doing a chart review, like, did you really? Or was it like, 20 squamous and a few bacteria? And you're like, I'm pretty sure they just sloughed their nether region into the urinalysis cup. But
I'm probably going to stop it off here, but have you ever looked into this is sort of another thing that's piqued my interest. Have you ever looked into the seasonal variation of infectious processes before?
Yeah. It's clearly like documented that like URI, like viral infections, et cetera, tend to peak September through April. And a lot of that is skewed by children, obviously the little vectors, that's when they're in school, et cetera, and just sort of communicating everything. So, from a seasonality standpoint, we know that, in terms of this specific disease process, I don't know.
Maybe we'll see, instead of Google flu trends, we can see Google spinal abscess trends.
There's actually a chart in the paper that was published in the Journal of American College of Radiology that looked at like sort of the pre-post intervention of this protocol. And there wasn't like a clear trend. Like there were upticks in November and February and May, but it's hard to know what to make, I don't even know what to make of that. It didn't seem like it was clearly trending up or clearly trending down and things like that.
And then as terms of trend of spinal abscess, there was a paper from Kentucky about 3, 4, 5 years ago that looked at sort of trends of spinal abscess. And they were trying to make the argument that it correlated with opioids, but like the number of opioid patients that actually like opioids as their risk factor didn't go up as much. So it was like four times as many spinal abscesses, but only 20% of people are, injecting heroin. So it was, I think it brought our attention to it.
Okay. We are going to end it there. Unfortunately, Lauren's answer to that got cut off. Basically she said, yes, at least it's a theory, but we don't have any definite data on it. I want to thank both Lauren and Patrick for doing this, especially for Patrick, because he's going to do even more of these. But Lauren, again, is an expert at this. She has been very exposed to this, and I am so happy we had her on. So thank both of them. And as one last thing, if you like this, please let us know, because we're going to be working on more of these. And Patrick is, again, the main person doing this. I'm just more or less doing the editing at this point and getting it on the website. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.